In the middle of 1788, the U.S. Constitution was ratified by enough states to make it binding. But we, the people, didn't really mean all the people that first time around. People were still allowed to own other people, and we didn't abolish slavery till the Civil War. In the middle of the 19th century, it was well into the 20th century that women got the right to vote under the Constitution. The 19th Amendment allowed women to vote all over the country, and it did not exactly breeze to ratification. It took 36 states to ratify an amendment then, and the bruising battle in number 36 is told in a new book by Elaine Weiss called The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Elaine Weiss spreads her journalism around from The Atlantic to The New York Times and on NPR and The Voice of America. Her previous book is Fruits of Victory, The Woman's Land Army of America and the Great War. Elaine Weiss, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
My pleasure.
We should probably get a glossary up front. Suffs and antis seems clear enough. But why were people who supported votes for women called suffragists or suffragettes?
Oh, well, that's my favorite little history lesson, which is I think we've all seen a little too much of Mary Poppins. And so we all like to sing the suffragette song. Suffragette was actually a term of derision that was invented by a British newspaper man in around 1906. And he was making fun of the women protesting for the vote in the United Kingdom. And so he put the diminutive, the et, at the end of suffragist, someone who is appealing for the vote, and made it into suffragette. And it made the newspapers loved it. It was kind of colorful. It was a little tweaking them. And so that was really aspersion that was being cast on them as a kind of funny little twist. So in America, it was not used by the suffragists themselves. They called themselves suffragists, I-S-T-S, and not ets, because that was, again, making fun of the movement. Not to say it wasn't used by newspapers and that, you know, even some women used it as a badge of honor, kind of saying, you can make fun of us, but we don't care. But it was not what they called themselves. So I insist in the book on using the word suffragist because that's what they called themselves.
All right, that is a good lesson. So this was not a new fight by 1920. I mean, how long had the battle for women's votes been going on in earnest in America?
Well, at least 72 years. We tend to time it from the time of the Seneca Falls conference, which is in July of 1848. But in fact, there'd been talk about this for decades before. Again, Abigail Adams famously writes to her husband John as they're drafting the Constitution to remember the ladies, to not make this a totally male-centered government. But, of course, they go ahead and do that. And at that point, it's not even all male citizens. It's only wealthy white citizens wealthy white male citizens who can vote. So women are talking about this amongst themselves, occasionally making complaints. Similar discussions going on in England. And it comes, there's a description in the book of how Elizabeth Cady Stanton attends a abolition meeting in London with her husband. And it's something to remember that the women who we think of as the foremothers of the suffrage movement actually come out of the abolition movement. But even in the enlightened abolition movement, women are not supposed to speak. They're not supposed to participate completely in organizing the movement. And she notices this. These American leaders are sent up to the balcony, the women's balcony, and not allowed to participate.
Wow.
And it's a kind of rude awakening to her, but she's been thinking about this for a long time. And it takes 8 years after that sort of slap in the face to organize a meeting in upstate New York, which we know as Seneca Falls in the Finger Lakes region. And so we tend to time the movement from then, but in fact, it was percolating for some time before.
Were women nice for a long time, and somebody finally made a break and said, that's it, we're going to toughen up, we're not going to be nice anymore?
Well, what they're doing, I think we have to understand just how difficult life was for women in the middle of the 19th century when this Seneca Falls meeting takes place. They not only have no right to vote, but they have no right to their own property. A married woman, any property she may have had from her family now belongs to her husband. Any wages, if she did work, if she was a craftsperson or a seamstress, any kind of income she made belonged to her husband. She could have no banking privileges for her own, especially if she's a married woman. A married woman is, as Stanton calls it, civilly dead. She also cannot press a suit in a court of law. She has no standing in a court of law. She cannot testify. She cannot serve on a jury. She has no custody rights of her children. The father has entire rights over the children. And so you see, it's not just the vote. It's a whole swath of rights that we kind of take it for granted that they do not have. And one of the things that at Seneca Falls is demanded is equal pay, which, of course, we've still not achieved.
Wow.
But again, they're thinking broadly, and the right to vote is one of the demands. It's a very far-reaching set of demands in those Declaration of Sentiments that comes out of there. And that becomes the template for meetings around the country in the next several decades to organize women.
All right. It really does take several more decades, seven more decades, in fact, plus two more years. 1848 was the Seneca Falls Convention, and then this vote in Tennessee's legislature in 1920 to make Tennessee the 36th state to ratify the amendment giving women the right to vote. That is the subject of Elaine Weiss's book, The Woman's Hour. We'll be back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk more with her in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is the journalist Elaine Weiss. We're talking about the women's right to vote enshrined in the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, ratified in the Tennessee legislature, the 36th state to do so, thereby making it an actual amendment to the Constitution. In August of 1920, the events are told in Elaine Weiss's book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we talk about women's right to vote and all of the battles that preceded it. Back to the Jefferson Exchange, you can join us at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Elaine, by the time all these people rolled into Nashville, Tennessee's capital, in the summer of 1920, had there been state-by-state fights for the months preceding this?
Oh, yes. So this is now the culmination of that seven-decade battle. There are two ways that women can be enfranchised. One is by their home state, because states are in charge of election laws. And so there have been battles in the states starting in the 1870s for the states to give their women the vote. And some do.
Wyoming
some
actually did it in, what, 1869 or so?
Pardon?
Wyoming, was it?
Yes,
1869?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Wyoming, when it comes in as a from a territory to a state, demands that women, their women, be able to vote. Oregon, actually, I'm going to remember, is something like 1911 or so, that finally there were several failed referenda, and then finally Oregon decides that their women can vote.
November 1912,
yeah. It can
be done
either by legislative action or by a popular referenda. And, of course, in both of those, it's only men who can vote. It's men deciding whether women deserve the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So the suffragists have to both organize enough women to campaign and then convince either the male electorate or the legislature, and sometimes both, because the legislature has to decide whether to put it on the ballot sometimes, whether they should have the vote. So they have been doing this, and they have certain, some states have given women the vote, but they know that in many states that's never going to happen. And the only way to have the vote for all women in all states in all elections is to have a federal amendment. That amendment had been introduced into Congress in 1878, and had been sitting there for 40 years.
Wow.
And every year the women would go up to testify before the congressional committees, and every year it'd be, you know, thrown into the file cabinet again. The Congress did not want to deal with it. So it's only after World War One, and American women have proved their patriotism by their war work and their whole other realm of political things are going on that force it out of Congress, and it's gone to the states for ratification. Three quarters of the states have to ratify, and in some of those states, it was a real battle. Some it sailed through, and some the legislatures were very reluctant, and in some states it only passed by, you know, a single or two votes. So it was not a sure thing, even in 1920, and most of the southern states, not all, but most of the southern states had already rejected the amendment. And even sort of moderate states, considered moderate states, like Delaware and Maryland, also rejected it. And so at this point in the summer of 1920, they have 35 states already in the yes column. They need one more. But it turns out that their best hope is Tennessee, which is a southern state, has all the problems of getting ratification in a southern state, which includes states' rights issues and also racism.
All right, I was going to ask you what the subtext was in Tennessee, and that's a couple of big ones right there.
Yeah.
Elaine Weiss is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We're talking about Tennessee in 1920. So let's meet some key players here. Give us a sketch on Carrie Catt. She was one of the leaders of the suffragists.
Yes, Carrie Catt's a fascinating, complex character. She is an Iowa farm girl who had been already at this point widowed twice. And she becomes an apprentice to Susan B. Anthony in the 1880s and 90s. And Susan Anthony grooms her for leadership. She sees she has the organizational skills. She's a great orator. And she has the kind of passion that marks her for leadership. So she really does groom this young woman to be her successor. And she does take over. There's a period when she leaves the presidency, and then she comes back in 1916 and announces that the woman's hour has struck, and we are going to go for this federal amendment. And it's finally time for women to grasp that elusive enfranchisement. And so she is both the president of the mainstream largest women's suffrage organization, the National American Association. She's also head of the International Women's Suffrage Association. And that gives us an idea that this is not just happening in America. There's this groundswell of women wanting to be part of their government, to have some say. And so there's a parallel movement very closely aligned in Great Britain. And they have just celebrated their centennial, where many women, not all, but many British women are given the vote in February of 1918. They just had all kinds of celebratory events over there. But there you had to be 30 years old and own property. It is a class society there, and so they decided that not all women would get it. But it's a big step. It's like that first big step. And it's going on in France. It's going on in Germany. They've just lost this terrible war, but they do give their women the vote. And in Russia, which has just gone through a revolution, the women get the vote. And so there are 26 nations that have the vote. And Carrie Katz says, how embarrassing that all these nations, including the ones we just, you know, were fighting with in the Great War, have given their women the vote. We fought to make the world safe for democracy, and our women don't have the vote. So she's this great orator. She comes down from headquarters in New York, and she, for the first time, she's going to lead the campaign on the battlefield, not just from New York. She comes in, she moves into a hotel room, and she's there for six miserable weeks. It's very hot. It's very tense. And she's there for the whole time. So she is probably the most famous woman in America at that time. She's a political leader. She's, a familiar face to President Wilson and governors and senators around the country. So she is a very famous woman who comes to Nashville to fight what she hopes will be the last battle, but she's kind of nervous that it may not work.
So, and then on the other side, we have Josephine Pearson, was a leader of the Antis, and she is a formidable opponent and defies some stereotypes as well.
Yes, she is the leader of the Tennessee women opposed to women's suffrage. And she is probably the most educated woman in among the combatants, if you'll say. Carrie Katz has a college education, but Josephine Pearson is actually a college professor at small, mostly Christian colleges at the time, mostly for women. But she's a dean. She's well-read. She's well-educated, but she's also very socially and religiously conservative. And she truly believes, as did her mother, that the idea that women could vote and have political power will change the American home. It'll destroy the idea of a mom and a dad, and mom takes care of the kids and dad goes off and does the important work of the world. And she thinks that's really important. Again, we see that same approach to what the nuclear family is about, and that women should be staying at home and stay in her sphere here in the 21st century. Certainly, I heard it a lot all during my time in the 20th century, and I think women have heard that for a long time. But I think it's important to realize that what Josephine Pearson represents, it's the understanding that the call for women's suffrage was never just a political argument. It was never just a political fight. It was a social and a cultural and, for some, a moral change. It was going to affect not just political, public life, but private life. It was going to change the dynamic in the family. And there are a lot of anti-suffrage broadsides and cartoons. And
the cartoons in particular, yeah. You include one in the book that's rather stark.
Yes, yes. And, you know, says, you're going to destroy American civilization if you allow women to vote. So it's almost more of what we would call today the culture wars. It's a very complicated, emotional, multi-layered kind of issue. And so it stirred great passion on both sides. And Josephine Pearson is representative of that group of women who are opposed to enfranchising their sisters. Now, with Josephine, and especially in the South, the women who have opposed suffrage are also seeing, casting it in the light of the Civil War, that this is sort of a continuation of the Civil War, the states' rights issue, and also that this they fear for the erosion of white supremacy. And it's not subtle. They say it blatantly. That is the subtext, that this is going to change the balance of the races in the southern states. Black men have had the vote since 1868, but of course in the southern states they've been effectively disenfranchised by onerous literacy and poll tax and physical intimidation and lynching. And so the southern states have figured out how to disenfranchise black men, and they really don't want to deal with black women, too.
So, of course, Tennessee was the focus of the battle over ratification as the 36th state, which would have put and did eventually put the 19th Amendment, the women's right to vote, over the top and made it part of the U.S. Constitution. All described in Elaine Weiss's book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. You can join the conversation on The Exchange and talk about women's suffrage and all the battles that it took to get just to that point in 1920 and where it's come since. 800-838-3760 to join the conversation by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. I'm still surprised by some of the people who oppose this, including, you talked about President Wilson, his wife, who was essentially running the country after the president's stroke. She didn't want women voting either.
Isn't that fascinating?
Truly.
Yes. Yes. Edith Wilson is just a vehement anti-suffragist. She really does not think women should vote. Of course, she is running the country because her husband has had a stroke and incapacitated. She seems to see no contradiction in that, in those two roles. And she is, gets especially emotionally angry at the suffragists when the more aggressive wing of the party, of the movement, the Women's Party, led by a young Quaker woman named Alice Paul, begins picketing the White House and personally holding Woodrow Wilson responsible for the lack of progress of the federal amendment through Congress. And so they are out there day and night, starting in January of 1917, protesting in front of the White House with picket signs, which had never been done before. And they say things like, Mr. President, what will you do for liberty? And calling him at one point Kaiser Wilson.
Ooh.
Which is a really, really... for some, goes beyond the pale. And even some suffragists are not happy about
it's
that.
It's like calling somebody a Nazi now.
Yeah, yeah, it is. So Edith Wilson looks outside the windows of the White House and sees these women picketing her husband, and she becomes very defensive. But mostly she is philosophically opposed to this. So you have that very interesting dynamic. Woodrow Wilson, who was opposed to women's suffrage for most of his career, and then tries, when he's president, tries to kind of wiggle his way out of any kind of commitment by saying, oh, it's a states' rights thing. The states have to decide that. But finally, he's kind of placed between pincers by the women suffrage movement and is converted, so to speak, to support a federal amendment. And part of his enthusiasm for this towards the end is he believes women, if they can vote in the 1920 election, will help convince Congress to approve his League of Nations campaign. He wants America to enter the League of Nations. There's great resistance to it in Congress. And so he's hoping that women, who tend to be, you know, portrayed as the peacemakers, will want America to enter into the League of Nations. So he's really cheering it on. So you have this very limited president. He's recovering from the stroke, but he's not up to full speed. And his wife, who's filtering everything that comes in for his consideration in the White House, and the suffragists trying to get messages to him to help them in Tennessee. So it's a very interesting dynamic going on in the White House. And then, of course, you have a presidential election going on. So you have the presidential candidates also having to weigh in on this idea of whether women will vote in the election that they're campaigning for.
I didn't realize Wilson was actually considering a third term,
yes.
Stroke and all, but that didn't happen. And so it ended up being Cox running as the Democratic candidate, with Franklin Roosevelt, the former Navy Secretary, as his vice presidential candidate against Warren Harding. So how did Cox and Harding come down on suffrage?
Very flip-floppery. They are, the suffragists don't trust either of them because they do kind of change their minds with the wind a bit. Neither have sterling records on on suffrage, though they're, you know, they're not opposed to suffrage, and they espouse support for the 19th Amendment and for ratification in Tennessee, but they don't follow through. And so a lot of the drama of the book is seeing how the women are trying to pin them down and how they're trying to evade making any kind of strong statement. They're under a lot of political pressure, because one of the surprising things for me is in doing the research and writing the book was, first of all, how long it took for women to get the vote. Second, that even in 1920, there was a substantial resistance to it. Third, I guess, is the racial aspect that is so strong. But the fourth is also that there is corporate interest, and there's corporate opposition to women voting. And some of what we see the presidential candidates waffling on it is that they're under corporate pressure.
Interesting. Okay, we'll have to explore that in a bit more depth when we come back. We're talking about what it took to get the 19th Amendment, the women's right to vote, ratified. It took an act of the Tennessee legislature in the hot summer of 1920 to get 36 states on board and thereby ratify it. That's the story that Elaine Weiss tells in her book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange and talk more with Elaine. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you in a minute 10. We're down to the final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Elaine Weiss. She's the author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We're talking about the Tennessee legislature acting to ratify the 19th Amendment to the Constitution in the hot summer of 1920, presidential election going on and everything. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange with your thoughts about women getting the right to vote and all the years it took, 72 years since the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I did want to look and see the order of events here. So the state ratifications, you got the first 11 inside of a month, then a bit of a drag after that. California was number 18, Oregon was number 25. That was in January of 1920. And then you get a fairly unlikely state to put this over the top, Tennessee, by the summer of 1920. And there's another wrinkle here, a twist in Tennessee law that stopped the legislature from considering ratification. What was that about?
Yeah, there was a part of the Tennessee Constitution which had been written in 1870 after the Reconstruction laws had gone through. Tennessee was an occupied Confederate state, and so they were, shall we say, it was a shotgun ratification in 1870 of the 14th and 15th Amendments. Mm-hmm. And which guaranteed citizenship and voting rights to black men. So they had put a clause in the Constitution saying that no federal amendment could be considered by a sitting legislature. Basically, any legislator would have to run on his approach to this.
So an election would intervene, sort of like
idea, whatever. Yeah. So I mean, it makes some sense, but it was clearly done to prevent the legislature from making a decision without public input. So it sounds good, but actually, it is against constitutional law because there's a very specific ratification process that the Constitution spells out. And so it went to the Supreme Court because other states also had other kinds of stop mechanisms. In Ohio, the anti-suffragists having, after the legislature ratified, they said, no, we want to have a referendum now. So they were trying to slow it down and perhaps reverse it in states. And it went to the Supreme Court, and June of 1920, the Supreme Court decides, no, the states can't do this. If they can delay it till after the next election, they could delay it for 5 years or 10 years. So they have to just do the process as speedily as possible. So the constitutional prohibition in the Tennessee Constitution gets thrown out, but it still is alive in the idea, in the minds of Tennessee politicians. And so they use it as an excuse. They know legally there's no standing for it, but they still say we will be violating our constitutional oath if we vote to ratify this. So it's used as a straw man to prevent to try to persuade the governor not to call a special session, to bring all the legislators back to Tennessee in the middle of the hot summer to work on this. So nobody wants it. The governor's up for re-election. He sure does not want to have to be in the middle of this ratification fight. The legislature is also up for re-election, and they're on vacation. They don't want to come back. There are all kinds of obstacles that the suffragists know they're going to face, chief among them that it's a southern state, and the race issue is going to come up, and the states' rights issue is going to come up. But it's their last best chance.
And as Tip O'Neill said, he was the Speaker of the House in the 80s, all politics is local. So who were the key players in the Tennessee legislature?
Well, it's such a fascinating array of characters. These are such great, juicy characters. They're a gift to any writer. In the legislature, there's the governor, Albert Roberts. And he really does not want to be thrown into this maelstrom of having to decide, especially being the decisive state. So he tries to duck at all times. He's under a lot of pressure. He's had a primary challenger, and so he's very nervous. And the suffragists really bear down on him. Then there is the Speaker of the House, a very ambitious young man named Seth Walker, who, again, is trying to ride the winds, see which way the winds are blowing. And at first he says, okay, I will support ratification. He promises it to the suffragists, and that's really important. He has a lot of clout as a speaker. But as we'll learn, he is not a reliable ally. And so you have a lot of legislators who are willing, some are very idealistic and purposeful and commit themselves to the suffragists and work very hard for them. And others are very willing to be persuaded by either money or liquor or political pressure to change their minds. And so what you see is this slow, once everyone arrives in Nashville for the legislative session, you have incredible, dramatic infighting going on. And it's fascinating because it's really the way legislators and Congress works today. It's those same dynamics are at work. Just as we saw, if anyone saw the Spielberg movie Lincoln about getting the 13th mm-hmm. Amendment through, it's very similar. It is very similar. And there's a lot of inherent drama in it because careers are at stake, ideals are at stake, large national issues like race and equality and democracy are at stake. Because when you think of this, this is really, what is America's attitude towards democracy? Who has a voice? Who, when we say we the people, who do we mean? And we're still asking that question. So this is not just an academic or kind of dramatic, cinematic review of history. This is questions we're still grappling with. And so we're watching our ancestors grapple with this in Tennessee. And then you have in the legislature a young man from Memphis named Joe Hanover, who's an immigrant. His parents come from Poland when he's 5 years old, and he believes in the American dream. And he thinks it's outrageous that his mother can't vote. And so he becomes a champion for the suffragists in the House and becomes their floor leader and really uses his political skills to maneuver and, in some cases, cajole some of the legislators to be constant and be faithful to the suffrage cause. And it's great to see him maneuvering this. And again, they're being bribed. There's kidnappings. There's fist fights. I mean, it's not dry politics by any means.
Boy, not at all. No, we're Elaine Weiss is our guest in the Exchange. Her book is The Woman's Hour. So lest anybody think it was over with the final vote on August 18th, what happened next?
Well, on August 18th, there's of course, this incredibly dramatic moment, which is, and I won't spoil it for your readers, but it all comes down to one vote, and a vote of conscience by the youngest member of the legislature, a 24-year-old freshman delegate from East Tennessee. And he gets a letter from his mother, and he changes his mind. So again, I won't spoil it. But that is not the end. He had been allied with the anti-suffragists, and they are very angry at him at this point. There are accounts of him having to escape the chamber and kind of secretly go out windows to get out of the Capitol. He is then vilified, and there are witnesses who attest that he was bribed, which is not true. So he's being thrown under the bus, shall we say, and dragged through the mud because he made this change. They even send emissaries of the anti-movement to his mother's farm in East Tennessee to get her to say that the letter she wrote to him was a fake. And
wow.
He says, no, I'm not going to do that. And then the anti-suffragists are still not giving up, and they have what they call indignation rallies all through the state, and these get very ugly. And the Ku Klux Klan shows up, and it becomes a sort of white supremacist rallies, because they're saying this is going to be the end of white supremacy in Tennessee, and we have to literally, the meeting posters say, save the South. And it's not subtle, not at all.
No.
And of course, it was very startling to me to see what happened this summer in Charlottesville and other places, and realizing that these kind of indignation meetings were, and that's something we've not seen the end of either.
No, that I could hear the echoes of that when you were talking about the indignation meetings. I was envisioning torches even if they weren't there.
Yeah, well, there were, actually.
Okay, there we go. So by the time, so 1920 ends with Tennessee ratifying. Albert Roberts loses his job as the governor of Tennessee in the election. Warren Harding is voted in as the U.S. president, so the old back to normalcy campaign. So let's get past World War One and all the weird upheaval of the previous 8 years with Wilson in office. Now, the postscript, though, I mean, did many women get registered in time for the 1920 elections?
Yeah, that's a really interesting postscript, as you say. No, not as many as the suffragists wanted. Part of this is that there's only like 10 weeks before the election, and in some states, the registration process is closed by the end of August when the 19th Amendment goes into effect. So they, in some states, the registration date was extended so women could vote, but in others, like Georgia, where they did not want black women to vote, they refused to allow any late registration. And so, again, manipulating voter law, which, again, is kind of modern issue for us now, they prevented all women from voting. And then, of course, there's the very heartbreaking instances of black women trying to vote in some parts of the South, not all, but in some at this point, and being turned away violently. And there are actually riots. There are race riots on Election Day 1920 when black women try to vote.
Wow. So now a postscript just from 2016. What now stands in Centennial Park in Nashville?
Oh, well, there's a group of women in Nashville who've been just amazing in raising funds, the private funds, and working through the bureaucracies of several cities to get suffrage memorial statues commissioned and created and placed in public spaces to make sure that the next generation, that this generation, remembers their heritage of freedom. And they really see it as, you know, these are symbols of equality. In this moment when we're talking about monuments to inequality or celebrating inequality, these are monuments to equality. And it's really exciting to watch. So there is already a statue in Knoxville of suffragists from each of the three grand divisions of Tennessee. There's I went to this beautiful dedication of a large monument in Centennial Park of the all the characters in my book, actually, of five women, including Juno Frankie Pierce, who's leader of the African-American suffragists in Nashville. And then in Memphis, there's one planned for next year that's going to honor suffragists from that area, including Joe Hanover, the young Memphis legislator who believes in the American dream. And Sue White, who is also one of the characters in the book, the young third generation suffragist who is impatient with how slow things are going. And she's a Tennessean, and I went to a dedication of a bust to her in her hometown of Jackson, Jackson, Tennessee, in West Tennessee. So there are wonderful commemorations of these. And oh, another one is going to be in Knoxville this in June.
All right, so all kinds of statues in Tennessee.
Right, and
to
of course
in
New York they're trying to get some statues of some of the suffragists in
all right.
Central Park.
Elaine Weiss, the Woman's Hour, thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
My pleasure.